Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Kamara-Sami. Later on in the programme, I see it every time I close my eyes. Those are the words of the widow of the man who was killed during July's assassination attempt against Donald Trump. She's been speaking to the BBC. We'll have that interview later on. But we'll be devoting a sizable part of the programme to developments in the Middle East. We'll be hearing about the latest situation in Lebanon, also from northern Israel, and we have a rare interview with a senior figure from Hamas. We're going to begin our coverage, though, in Iran, where days after he ordered a large-scale ballistic missile attack on Israel, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has been leading Friday prayers in Tehran. It is the first time he has performed that role in 5 years. And it comes as Iranians are bracing themselves for the promised Israeli response to Tuesday's attack, part of a cycle of retaliation following the recent killing of senior figures from the Iranian-backed Lebanese militia Hezbollah, including its leader Hassan Nasrallah. The Ayatollah told a huge crowd at the Grand Mosalla Mosque that Iran and its allies must roll up their sleeves and prepare for action.
We have not opened our eyes to this reality, and we've seen the result. We should open our eyes today. We should be awakened. We should fasten the seatbelt of resistance from Iran to Afghanistan, from Gaza to Lebanon, in every Islamic countries. We should fasten the seatbelt of resistance.
Parham Gobadi is a senior reporter with BBC Persian. So, what is the significance of the Ayatollah addressing the crowd after Friday prayers in Tehran?
So this was the first time that Ayatollah Khamenei, Iranian supreme leader, led the Friday prayer after almost half a decade. And the last time he did that was when Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in Iraq by a U.S. drone at the direct order of former President Donald Trump. Before that, it was back in 2012. So it shows usually he delivers Friday prayer at a time of heightened tension. So it shows that how important it was for him that Hassan Nasrallah, one of his oldest and best allies in the region, was assassinated in Lebanon. So, and he used a really strong language criticizing both Israel and the United States. He called Israel a vampire regime and United States rabid dog in the region. He also praised his armed forces for retaliating against Israel, carrying out a missile strike. He said that Iran will neither hesitate nor rush when it comes to its retaliation. He also praised Hamas's October 7th attack against Israel, calling it a legitimate and an appropriate act against Israel.
And part of the speech was delivered in Arabic, wasn't it? What's the significance of that?
That's correct. So it shows that Ayatollah Khamenei does not only he sees himself as the leader of Iran, he probably sees himself as the leader of the entire Muslims in the world, at least as the leader of all the Shiites in the world. And probably he knows that he's not only addressing the Iranians, but also his allies in the region, as what he calls them, axis of resistance, which means Iranian proxies in the region, from Houthis in Yemen to different militia groups like Kataib al-Hezbollah in, for example, Iraq, Syrian militias, and also Hezbollah fighters in Lebanon.
What about his own security? So many senior allies, as you say, assassinated in the last couple of weeks. What can we say about that?
So Reuters news agency reported that he was taken to a secure location. I think this was a reaction maybe to that report, that he wanted to show strength, convey a message that he's strong and he's not hiding. But according to Reuters news agency and their sources, he's extremely worried about Israel's infiltration inside Iranian armed forces, especially the Revolutionary Guards, because knowing where Hassan Nasrallah is, you know, somewhere deep in the ground, is extremely probably worrying for him. Ismail Haniyeh, Hamas's leader, was assassinated one day after meeting Ayatollah Khamenei in Tehran, a day after Iranian president was inaugurated. A day after that, he was assassinated in Tehran. So probably he must be really concerned about infiltration, Israeli infiltration.
We did see celebrations in Tehran after the missile strikes on Israel, but there are many different shades of opinion in Iran. What's the reaction been to his speech and the language he's used?
So, like always, we see huge crowds getting there, waiting for his Friday prayer and delivering his sermon. But we need to keep in mind that many of these people are bused to such occasions. So the government officials, you know, prepare the buses, prepare everything for people to carry them, to show the strength of the Iranian leader. But when you see social media, when people contact us, we see that, as you said, there are different opinions in Iran. Some people, obviously the Iranian hardliners, supported the Iranian missile strike against Israel. However, there are others who are extremely worried about a full-blown war between Iran and Israel, or even the United States. And we've received so many comments from Iranians that they say that dropping bombs is not going to achieve democracy in Iran.
BBC Persian's Parham Kobadi. Well, Sassan Karimi is a diplomatic advisor to the Tehran Chamber of Commerce. What did he take from Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's speech?
The message coming from Iranian Supreme Leader was a serious and powerful message, in my belief, that he was actually finishing the point and the red lines made more powerful and colorful, that the red lines are red enough and Israel is not permitted and will not be tolerated if want to breach again.
But isn't the reality that the axis of resistance, as it's called in Iran, is being weakened, significantly weakened, not just Hamas in Gaza, but Hezbollah has had senior members killed. It's had its ability to communicate, carry out operations, has been seriously degraded in the last few weeks. Iran is now in a much weaker position, isn't it?
Actually, the axis of resistance started from zero. Remember that 30 years, 40 years ago, it was no axis of resistance. But today, it is not zero. It is only the most senior faces, most senior faces are terrorized by Israel. And definitely, the next generation will come with more powerful mentality and also more energy coming with them as new faces, and actually the axis of resistance and also all other strategic powers, including groups or countries or governments, states or armies, and none of them could be relied only on persons and limited sort of persons.
So was this what the Ayatollah was trying to do then, was trying to establish and bolster this axis by reaching out, talking to Muslim nations more generally, talking in Arabic? Was that trying to get more recruits, if you like, or people on side to fight for Iran?
Definitely, he tried to, and he made it more, you know, unified, and sent his message to the Lebanese and Palestinian parts of the axis of resistance, but definitely it is not because of getting weakened, this is a new generation need to be led today as their beginning of and their career as the leaders, actual leaders of different parts of the axis of resistance.
Can I ask about what you're expecting in the next few days, though? There's been talk, and President Biden seemed to let slip that there is open discussion about this, that Iran's oil facilities might be struck by Israel. Is that what you were expecting?
Actually, no. Because first one, I hope that Israel do not want to be more crazy than before to continue escalation of violence in region. So now, today, everybody can understand who is the state or the regime that is escalating violation and terrors in the region.
Sassan Karimi, diplomatic advisor to the Tehran Chamber of Commerce. A bit later, we'll be assessing what Israel's response might be. But we're going to turn now to the situation in Lebanon, where Israel has continued to intensify its attacks on Hezbollah targets, both in the south of the country and in the capital, Beirut, where, incidentally, Iran's foreign minister has been speaking today. And it's also been reported a key border crossing with Syria has been hit. The presumed target of one massive overnight airstrike in the Lebanese capital is a man thought to be the likely successor to the assassinated leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah. I've been hearing more about the situation in Lebanon from our correspondent Hugo Bashega, who's in Tripoli in the north of the country.
So we had those huge airstrikes overnight in Beirut, and they were very powerful. You could hear the explosions across the city. And reports suggest the target of this attack was the man expected to become the next Hezbollah leader, Hashim Safieddine. He was believed to be in an underground bunker. His fate is still unclear, but I think this gives us an indication that this Israeli campaign against Hezbollah is likely to continue. I think Israel is intended in degrading Hezbollah and Hezbollah's future by targeting its leadership, but also apparently the man believed to be the next leader of the group. And across the country, those Israeli airstrikes have continued. There was an attack that cut off a road leading to the main crossing point between Lebanon and Syria. The Israeli military said it was targeting underground tunnels being used by Hezbollah to smuggle weapons. And in the south, the main hospital in the town of Majanyun was evacuated after an Israeli airstrike nearby.
Hugo, you're in the north now, aren't you? Just tell us what the situation is like there.
So this is Tripoli, about an hour's drive from Beirut. And we are seeing this growing crisis caused by the number of people who've been displaced by this conflict. 1.2 million people, according to the Lebanese authorities. And a lot of people have arrived here in Tripoli. And we've been told by one of the local NGOs that around 100,000 people are here, fleeing not only the south, Beirut, but a lot of people have come from the Bekaa Valley. These are areas where Hezbollah has a very strong presence. And obviously, this is putting a lot of pressure on the authorities, and the UN is saying today that almost all shelters across the country are completely full and a rising number of people are sleeping in streets. Lebanon has faced years of economic crisis, so I think, you know, the government has a very limited ability to provide the help that these people need. And, you know, many of those people are telling us that they have nowhere to go. And there is the real concern that if this conflict continues and there is no sign that we're going to see any kind of ceasefire at the moment, this is a situation that is going to become much worse. And I think there is the real fear here that many of those people, because of the destruction that we're seeing in the south, because of the military activity of the Israeli military in the south of the country, many of those people may never be able to go back home again.
BBC's Hugo Bashega in northern Lebanon. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up later, we'll hear from the widow of a volunteer firefighter who died while shielding his family at a rally where there was an assassination attempt on Donald Trump back in July.
The day before he was killed, my youngest daughter pulled out his senior photo that he had given to me, and on the back, he had thanked me for being his best friend, and he actually teared up.
Headlines at this hour. Ayatollah Khamenei has delivered a defiant sermon in Tehran, saying that Iran and its allies will not back down in their confrontation with Israel. Israel is pressing on with its offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon, with heavy bombing in Beirut and a new evacuation order for towns in the south. And EU member states have backed a plan to impose big tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, raising the prospect of a trade war. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. We were hearing a couple of minutes ago from our correspondent Hugo Bashega in Lebanon about the Israeli airstrikes on various targets inside that country. Of course, Hezbollah continues to fire missiles in the other direction into northern Israel, as we're about to hear. Shelley Barkan is a teacher. She lives in the town of Shlomi, near the Israel-Lebanese border. She's spoken to us on NewsHour before. The last time was in August. Then, Shelley said, she was one of around 200 people who'd stayed in a place which has a population normally of 8,000. Today, she told me that since then, another 100 people have returned. So, what does she put that down to?
I think that people have had enough of not being in their own homes. I don't think that for months on end, it's nice to live in a hotel. Most families were given two rooms, one for four, could be four kids and for the parents.
Of course, the reason...
Like in the south, people have also gone back to their homes, even though it's still dangerous, even though we're still under fire, even though we're still in a war.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Clearly, the reason people left was because rockets are coming from Hezbollah in their direction, and that's not stopped, has it?
Yeah, not at all. I think it's even gone worse in the last since we've gone into Lebanon. But I think in a way people maybe are a little bit used to it.
But presumably nothing like ordinary life has resumed, has it?
I mean, it's not an ordinary life. For example, in Shlomi there's no ordinary life. There's no children, there's nothing open, there are no supermarkets. Nobody's living an ordinary life in Israel at the moment, nowhere. The children are not at school. They're on Zoom. Rockets are flying everywhere now. They've got to Tel Aviv. They've got to Haifa. They've got to places they've never been before. Can you hear? There's a siren.
Yes, I can hear it. That's just happening the whole time, is it?
And here I go. Yeah, I'm meeting my neighbour. We stand under the stairs. We don't even go into the shelter. So this is my life, you understand?
Well, you said in the past you'd go into a shelter, but now it's so frequent you're just... Going under the stairs.
No, I don't bother going into the shelter. I've also got animals and my dogs don't like going into the shelter with me.
I think we just heard one of the dogs there, didn't we?
Yeah.
You say since the troops went in on the ground, things have perhaps got even worse.
They've escalated. We're having 7-8 sirens a day in Shlomi. I think that the whole of Israel is petrified because we just do not know where it's going to fall.
Do you think this was the right thing to do, though, to go in? On the ground.
Absolutely, without a doubt, and even more so since they went in. I really believe that it is the mentality of our enemies, that if we are not strong and show them who the boss is, we are never, ever, ever going to get rid of this problem, ever. We are going to have enemies and we're going to live in fear for the rest of our lives. My great-grandchildren are still going to be living in fear. These people want to murder us. It's very simple. If someone wanted to murder you, what would you do? Try and talk to them.
Already, some Israeli soldiers have died in this operation.
That's right. That's the most terrible thing.
Yeah, I mean, there will almost certainly be more, won't there?
One life, but there's nothing we can do, because if we want Israel to exist, then unfortunately, and I really say it because I've got two of my own children, I could not think that it must be the most terrible thing in the world. Your life is never again the same.
All wars eventually end with some kind of talks. Do you see people that Israel can talk to at the moment?
I don't see. The enemies do not want to talk to us. There are other countries that are trying.
I mean, people like you living in areas close to the border, are you going to have to accept then that for the near future, it is almost a perpetual state of war?
I don't think people will come back if that's what's going to be.
What's it going to take, do you think, for people to feel secure enough to return? Because that clearly is the objective of this operation.
Well, I think that, you know, what happened on the 7th of October is it took the Israeli citizens also for a knock, because they just could not believe what happened on that day, not only because of the enemy, but also because of the trust between the government and the IDF and what went wrong that day. But I do think that slowly the trust has come back, and I think that people today obey the IDF. So I do think that if they tell the people in the north that they come back, it will be with 100% trust. But I don't know what it will take in order for that to happen, because it just seems that it's never ending.
Teacher Shelley Barkan in northern Israel. Let's move away from the Middle East now, because the Amazon rainforest in Brazil has been experiencing its worst wildfires in two decades. More than 62,000 square kilometres have burned this year alone. The majority of the fires have started criminally. They've been made worse, though, by Brazil's worst drought on record. Our South America correspondent Ione Wells reports.
It was burning more than 15 days.
Imagine that it is your home, the place you live, that's on fire. That's the very real situation for the indigenous community of Caichitu.
If these fires continue, we, the indigenous people, will no longer have life.
Raimundinha Rodrigues da Souza is the chief of the local indigenous fire brigade team that's been trying to put out fires here.
Because today it is killing the plants. In a while, it will be us, because we inhale so much. It is a very aggressive fire that really kills everything that comes its way. When we arrive at the scene and monitor the area to see where it started, we know whether it was arson, because we find a bottle, often a bottle of gasoline, a match tip.
As we speak, she spots smoke emerging from some of the trees behind us, a sign another criminal fire has been started just after they finished putting some out there. We're with the fire brigade team now, and they found a fire. It's a small one, but it's certainly significant. These fires are a disaster, but not a natural one. In most cases, the match was lit by a human. Loggers, miners, farmers, clearing land. In many cases, illegally. You can see big fields, piles of logs everywhere on the side of the road here. Many argue it's a waste to leave so much land protected rather than productive. Doris Marluise Baruffi is a farmer. He's legally owned land here for many years, but he explained why there's been such a boom in farming in the Amazon.
I think it is due to the growth of the population that has increased planting up here. It rained well here. I believe if you're working within the law, there's no problem here. It is a place that provides food. It is a state that can produce a lot. So I think there is still a lot of area to be cultivated here in Amazonas.
These fires might be started by humans, but they're made worse by a record drought in Brazil that is turning the forest into a tinderbox. Every day, people like João Mendoza have to collect water from parts of the river where there is still some and bring it to their community where there isn't.
It's the worst drought I've ever seen in my entire life.
João and others are carrying huge, heavy bottles of water on their backs, walking far in the baking sun, barefoot, across what would have been the riverbed of the Madeira River, a tributary of the Amazon. Now, though, the ground is very, very dry, covered in huge cracks. There's absolutely no water to be seen here.
It has brought a lot of consequences. The absence of food on the riverside dwellers' table, the fish are gone. One of the biggest difficulties today is access to the city without the river. There are elderly people, people with chronic illnesses, who have to make this journey.
The impact on local communities here is really obvious, but this matters more widely for the whole world too. The world relies on the Amazon to absorb a lot of its carbon, but as you can see, just looking at the sky here, covered in smoke, it's now emitting record amounts itself.
And that report from the Amazon rainforest in Brazil was by the BBC's Ione Wells. You're listening to NewsHour.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to News Hour. Coming up next, we have a rare interview with a senior official from Hamas. First, though, the World Health Organization has approved the first emergency diagnostic test for Mpox. The PCR test enables the virus to be detected from human skin lesions. It's hoped it will help to fight the latest outbreak, which has been centered on the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dr. Margaret Harris is spokesperson for the World Health Organization and joins us now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, James.
Can you just bring us up to date with the situation in Central and Western Africa at the moment with Mpox?
Yes, we've still got a really huge outbreak with Mpox. In Central Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo is the worst affected country. They've got more than 30,000 cases. And sadly, 990 people have, so almost 1,000 people have died in 2024 from this. And this is one of the reasons we are so concerned. And Burundi is the second most affected country in Central Africa. They've got more than 850 confirmed cases, and so far they've not reported any deaths. But in West Africa, we've got Nigeria with a huge number of cases as well. We've also got cases in other parts of West Africa.
So the tests, where do they come in? How important are they?
Really important. First of all, early detection. If you quickly know that this is definitely Mpox, you can do many of the things you need to do, get them to timely care, isolate them if necessary to reduce the risk of onward transmission. But it's also very, very important to understand so that everybody else knows that they've been in contact with Mpox, because that helps determine who might benefit most from vaccination.
It's a new test. How reliable can we say it is?
Well, we wouldn't have given it the emergency use listing unless we knew it was reliable, because we measure this by three things. Is the thing effective? Is the thing safe? And is it being produced, manufactured to a standard that we consider acceptable? So you've got to meet those criteria. And PCRs are actually the gold standard for any viral testing, because they're really, really good at picking up viral DNA, even tiny amounts. And in fact, the results will tell you how much virus the person's got in their body, depending on the particular result.
And how quickly can you roll these tests out?
Well, now, this is a good question. It will depend on several factors, including manufacturing capacity. So it's dependent on how quickly the manufacturer can produce it, how well it can be easily purchased. But because it's now received the emergency use listing from us, it means that the partners working on Mpox can procure it quickly and provide it more quickly.
And briefly, immunisation, that's underway as well, isn't it?
Well, certainly vaccines have been distributed. And one of the important things around vaccination is using what you've got very wisely. And one of the best ways to do it is actually to vaccinate where you know contact is happening.
Dr. Harris, sorry, we have run out of time, but really appreciate you joining us, spokesperson for the World Health Organization there. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from London with James Kamara-Sami. As we've been hearing, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has delivered a rare sermon in Tehran, using the occasion to say Iran and its regional allies will not back down in their confrontation with Israel. It comes as the Israeli authorities are measuring their response to Tuesday's ballistic missile attack by Iran. They're also continuing, of course, to attack Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. They are not the only fronts, though, Israel's fighting on overnight. The IDF carried out its single biggest attack in the occupied West Bank since 2000. According to the Israel authorities, a local Hamas leader was among 18 people who were killed in an airstrike on a cafeteria in the Tulkarm refugee camp. Jonathan Conricus is senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a think tank in the United States. He's a former spokesperson for the Israel Defense Forces, and he served for 24 years as a combat commander in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip. Welcome to NewsHour.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There's a lot, isn't there? Many fronts, multiple fronts at the moment. I mean, let's start with what's happened in the West Bank. It's probably getting less attention than it would normally. According to the IDF, a local Hamas leader has been killed, but 18 in total, including, it's thought, some civilians. I mean, is this now the norm?
Yes, there's a lot going on because we're seeing basically what's unfolding is the Iranian strategy against Israel, and that is to arm, equip, and fund different terrorist organizations that are fighting against Israel. So all of the things that you spoke about, what's happening in Judea and Samaria, Lebanon, Gaza, and indeed distant Iran, is part of that same strategic picture. Now, regarding...
Sorry, just for our listeners who don't know, that's how you refer to what's referred to as by the rest of the ones, the occupied West Bank, but carry on, please.
Yes, yeah. I prefer to use what it's been called thousands of years before anybody made up the name West Bank. But we won't get into semantics, and I'll just answer the question. So in terms of what's going on, it is indeed an escalation. And I think you're correct. In any other normal news cycle, this would have been leading item because it is indeed a drastic development. What's basically been happening is that the Palestinian Authority gradually over the last 5 years has been losing control over Palestinian cities. Palestinian cities that are Area A under the Oslo Accords. And what's been happening is that various Hamas and other terrorist organizations have been taking control. Tul Karem is very, very close to the 1949 armistice line and just a stone throw away from many Israeli communities in other parts of Israel. And hence the sensitivity to any militant activity there is very low. The sensitivity is very high in Israel. And that's why you see Israeli authorities not taking any risks.
Right. Well, not taking risks. What about the big one that people are now wondering, Israel, and what its response is going to be to those Iranian ballistic missile strikes? We heard President Biden suggest that maybe Israel's looking at attacking oil installations. What is your sense? What are you hearing about the kind of conversations perhaps between the administration in Washington and the Israelis about what should happen next?
Yeah, so I think Israel has probably the best opportunity to retaliate against Iran that it hasn't had for about 20 years. And Israel is, I think, contemplating different types of targets, one of them being economic, as you mentioned, economic and military related. The second one could be regime related targets, symbols of governance and seats of governance, and perhaps indeed also key personnel. And the third,
regime change, is this?
Well, it could be showing the weakness and the hollow nature of the Iranian regime and perhaps telling the feared organizations in Iran that they are not as powerful as they may believe to be.
Well,
may be that, but I think that the Americans, indeed, it doesn't seem as if the U.S. is on board with doing exactly that much, and we haven't spoken about the nuclear facilities either. So what I think is currently, can you stand now? What I think is currently relevant is for Israel to first and foremost deal with the military capabilities of the Islamic Republic of Iran, its air defenses and its missile capabilities, because that is what been bothering Israel.
Jonathan Conricus, thanks very much indeed. Now, one of the most senior leaders of Hamas, which is designated a terrorist organization by the UK and other governments, has told the BBC the current crisis they provoked in the Middle East, which has led to the deaths of thousands of people in the past year, is justified. The deputy leader of Hamas, Khalil al-Hayya, has been speaking to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
With an Israeli attack looming, Iran and its allies are trying to rally. The Iranian president was in Qatar, embracing Khalil al-Hayya and the political leadership of Hamas, whose attack on Israel last October started a year of war and a crisis that is deepening. Khalil al-Hayya became the most senior Hamas leader outside Gaza after Israel assassinated his predecessor, Ismail Haniyeh, in July. His leg was broken in the attack and he was still in a surgical boot when we met him in Doha a few hours before Iran attacked Israel on Tuesday.
Let us go back to the 7th of October last year. Why did Hamas attack Israel?
We had to sound an alarm to the world to tell them that we are a people with a cause and demands. It was a blow to Israel, the Zionist enemy, and a wake-up call to the international community. We had to do something that would tell the world that there is a people who have been under occupation for decades.
Why did your men kill so many civilians, children as well?
We ordered our resistance fighters on the 7th of October not to target civilians, women and children. The objective was the occupation soldiers, who were always killing, bombing and destroying in Gaza. We don't endorse harming civilians. On the ground, there were certainly personal mistakes and actions. The fighters may have felt that their lives were in danger.
Your men who weren't in danger, they were standing with terrified civilians who were sitting on the ground and they were standing over them with weapons. That is not a battle.
We've all seen how the fighters went into the houses, they spoke to the families, they ate and drank.
They were shooting them. There are videos.
When they went into some of the houses, none of the women and children they dealt with were terrified. Those videos were published by the Israeli occupation. They weren't published by us.
Almost a year later, Gaza is in ruins. There are more than 40,000 dead. Many, many of them are civilians. Your capacity to fight Israel has been massively diminished. Was it worth all of that?
Who's responsible for this? It was the occupation and its army. Who destroys Gaza? Who killed its people? Who is now killing civilians in shelters, schools, and hospitals? Ask the world and those who created international law. We are defending ourselves. If 1,200 people from the occupation are killed, how does that justify Israel killing 50,000 people and destroying all of Gaza? Isn't that enough for them? But they are motivated by the lust to kill, to occupy, and the lust to destroy.
The Israelis say very clearly that they respect the laws of war, and they also say that the reason why so many civilians have died is because you and Hamas fight from within the civilian population and you use them as human shields.
That is not true. They destroyed mosques on top of the heads of their owners when there were no fighters. They destroyed houses and high-rise buildings when no one was in them. They bombed houses when there were not a single fighter in them. It is all Israeli propaganda.
Israel says that under the right circumstances, they would have a ceasefire. What about a ceasefire, for example, where you simply give back the hostages and the war ends? Would you accept something like that? That's been talked about, I know.
The question is, when will Netanyahu decide to stop the war? When will the world compel him to stop the war? It is the decision of Netanyahu and the Israel occupation to continue the war.
You could do it. You could surrender.
How can we surrender? People who resist the occupation do not give up. If we surrender, which is impossible, our children, our people, won't give up. If the world gave us our legitimate rights, this cycle of violence would stop. But Israel does not want that. The return of refugees and self-determination. The region will not calm down, no matter how much death and killing take place. The world needs to understand that Israel wants to burn the whole region.
For you, is the Israeli state part of the future? The Hamas Charter said that the Zionist state had to be destroyed.
We say that Israel wants to eliminate Hamas and the Palestinian people. Israel is crying and claiming that Hamas and the Palestinian people want to destroy it. Let's ask what Israel thinks of the Palestinian people. Give us our rights. Give us a fully sovereign Palestinian state.
The Israelis say that the reason why they don't accept a two-state solution is because they fear that people like you want to destroy their state and kill their people.
So far, Israel does not recognize a one-state solution or a two-state solution. Israel rejects it all, international resolutions, international law, and our rights.
Do you think of yourself as a terrorist? That's what Israel calls you.
I'm seeking freedom and defending my people. To the occupation, we are all terrorists, the leaders, the women, and the children. You heard what Israeli leaders called us. They said we were animals.
About an hour after the interview, Iran attacked Israel. As the Middle East war widens, the Israelis still insist on total victory over Hamas. The US and its allies, including the UK and Saudi Arabia, all say Middle East peace requires a secure Israel alongside an independent Palestine. But right now, military action, not diplomacy, is setting the pace.
Jeremy Bowen. And Jeremy has been explaining why it's editorially justified to air the views of a senior figure responsible for the October the 7th attacks.
Well, it's called journalism. I mean, you have to try and talk to everybody if you're interested in impartial reporting. You don't just try and do comfortable interviews with people that, say, the government of the country you come from represent. In, well, 40 years as a BBC journalist, most of that time as a foreign correspondent, I have often interviewed people who weren't seen, who were actually seen as sort of beyond the pale. In Saddam Hussein's Iraq, Colonel Gaddafi, when NATO was bombing him, President Bashar al-Assad at the height of the war in Syria, etc., etc. If you want to find out what's going on, you have to talk to people and try and challenge them. It's not a question of giving them a platform. It's a question of finding out what they think.
And that was our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. And just a reminder, if you want to keep up to date with events in the Middle East, and they are moving in many different directions, as we've been discussing on the programme, you can always go to our website. Just go to bbc.com/news. We have a live page there, including at the moment the latest claims from the IDF. They've killed 250 Hezbollah members in recent days. There's also a dispatch from Hugo Bashega. We heard from him earlier on the programme, talking about the strikes continuing to take place in Lebanon and the displacement of the people there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. The former US First Lady Melania Trump makes few public statements, even fewer on political matters. So her intervention on reproductive rights is attracting plenty of attention. In his election campaign, her husband Donald, the former president and Republican nominee for president this time round, has been taking credit for appointing Supreme Court justices who have removed universal access to abortion. But he's also been trying to avoid the anger that has followed that ruling. Melania Trump, well, she's come out unequivocally on the side of abortion rights, both in her new memoir published next week and in a video statement posted on X and timed for its release.
Individual freedom is a fundamental principle that I safeguard. Without a doubt, there is no room for compromise when it comes to this essential right that all women possess from birth, individual freedom. What does my body, my choice really mean?
Well, we're joined now by Pam Pollard, former chair of the Oklahoma Republican Party. She's in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the state capital. She's out campaigning and joins us. Welcome to the program, Pam.
Glad to be with you.
What do you make of Melania Trump's intervention in this?
Well, I don't know if it's an intervention. I will say that it's part of her memoir that has been timed for a long time to come out right before the election. But I support everyone's freedom of speech. And I'm glad that the First Lady feels like that she has the freedom to stand up and speak what's on her heart, even though many of us in the Republican Party disagree with her opinion. It doesn't mean that we don't disagree with her right to come out and speak for what she believes in.
Will it influence the election, do you think? I mean, she is an influential figure in the party, isn't she? And she's speaking, I guess, to those who perhaps don't agree with you. And that appears to be the majority of the American public who still, by I think 2/3 to 1/3, favour abortion rights in some cases.
I don't think it's going to necessarily influence the election as far as this being a great revelation that could cause more people, you know, to vote for President Trump, that would put him over the top. This is in all of the polls that are done. Abortion is issue number 9 or 10 down. The number one issue that women, this is a poll of women, middle-aged women, the number one issue is the economy. The number two is border and security for their families. So that's what women really care about. I think that it's interesting to them to hear that Melania agrees with them. But as far as it being a deciding issue, they're more concerned about the economy and the border.
But there are
right
fine margins potentially in this election, are there not? And this could reassure some women who would want to vote Republican but are concerned about abortion rights.
I think that her statement may bring a few more people in to vote for her husband, but I think that there's also a danger of this offending people who believe in the fundamental right of the baby that is inside the womb.
Yes,
that's
I was going to ask you. You think this could have the opposite effect? Someone very close to Donald Trump speaking this way could turn off some who thought he was in favor of the same issues as you.
No, I think because the bottom line is I agree with the Supreme Court. This issue is not addressed in our Constitution, or in our Constitution directly says that issues not defined in this are sent back to the states. So when the Supreme Court decided that, they did not agree to overturn Roe v. Wade. They agreed with the Dobbs decision, and the Dobbs said this is a state issue. So each state is going to have the ability and the freedom to vote on it. And they know that the power is with the state, not with the president.
Pam Pollard, many thanks. Now, it's 3 months since Donald Trump survived an assassination attempt at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. But two people in the crowd sustained life-altering injuries. And one man, 50-year-old volunteer firefighter named Corey Comprator, died while shielding his wife and daughters. Corey's widow, Helen, has been speaking exclusively to the BBC's Gary Donahue about her husband and her tremendous loss.
Corey was very quiet. He was always very straight-faced and serious, but he was so sweet and kind. He did anything for his community. He loved his kids. His kids were everything to him. Wonderful husband.
How did you guys meet?
In school.
Really?
Yeah, we went to school together since kindergarten. So I've known Corey my whole life, pretty much.
So you really were sweethearts from the very beginning?
Yeah. Yeah.
A friend as well as a husband?
Best friends. And what was weird was the day before he was killed, my youngest daughter pulled out his senior photo that he had given to me, and on the back he had written that I was his best, thanked me for being his best friend. And he actually teared up and looked at me and said, thank you for being my best friend. So it was just kind of weird that we had that moment, you know, the day before.
And what were his passions? What did he care about?
He was very passionate about his people under his roof. Everything was about his family under his roof. He was very passionate about God and, you know, things like that. And he loved Trump.
How do you feel about the day itself now? It's so raw and so recent. Is it something you can think about, or do you find it hard to?
No, I think about it every day. I see it every time I close my eyes. And probably will for a long time.
So now I ask that we observe a moment of silence in honor of our friend Corey.
All day, Corey kept saying, guys, I have to sit on the end over here because he's going to call me on stage and I have to be able to get down. He's going to say, Corey, I need you, bud. It's time for you to come up here. And it was like the joke all day. So, you know, obviously then he was killed. And then I just cried because, you know, I said he got his moment on stage with Trump. So, you know, it was kind of like a nice moment, but it was a sad moment at the same time. But
must have made you proud.
It did.
Do you feel angry about losing him?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very. Yep. I'm angry because there were a lot of mistakes made that day. And it didn't have to happen.
Helen Comprator.
Didn't have to happen.
Helen Comprator ending this edition of NewsHour.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.